content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. And today's program will start with an article from the March 2021 issue of Smithsonian Magazine from the prologue section titled The Fever That Struck New York by Carolyn Eastman. The front lines of a terrible epidemic through the eyes of a young doctor profoundly touched by tragedy. Word of the disease in New York City came from every quarter. The place was besieged. Thousands fled to the countryside, so many that transportation became impossible to find. Others huddled inside their homes. Many died. Hospitals were overrun, and nurses and doctors were among the earliest to succumb. People who ventured out held a handkerchief up in their nose and mouth, fearful of what they might breathe in. Wild claims about miracle drugs and regimens tricked some into believing they could outwit the disease. They couldn't. It was 1795, and the yellow fever, which had burned through Philadelphia 2 years earlier, killing more than 10% of the city's population, had arrived in New York. It would return in 1798, and those two epidemics killed between 3,000 and 3,500 New Yorkers. Hundreds in other parts of the East Coast died in localized outbreaks, almost always in urban centers. A lethal, highly contagious disease that tears through urban populations and shuts down normal life is a phenomenon we can appreciate during the COVID-19 pandemic. Recognizing these parallels, I revisited a startlingly detailed account of those terrifying outbreaks of more than 200 years ago, a young physician's unpublished diary, which I came across in the rare book and manuscript library at Columbia University. It's an extraordinary, closely observed chronicle of a young man's life and how the disease changed it. The Manhattan-born Alexander Anderson, or Sandy, as friends and family called him, wrote with great curiosity about the world around him, and even sketched images in the margins. His personality leaps from the page. The diary fills three volumes, the first of which he began in 1793, as a 17-year-old medical student at Columbia. Yellow fever would have such a profound impact on him that he would eventually leave medicine to work instead as an artisan, becoming a renowned engraver. An unfinished portrait of him in the collections of the Metropolitan Museum of Art shows a wide, friendly face with black hair and eyes, evoking the openness with which he seemed to approach to life. In 1795, with the number of yellow fever cases growing alarmingly, the city of New York opened Bellevue Hospital, where doctors could isolate the seriously ill. It stood several miles upriver from the densely populated area of Lower Manhattan, where Sandy Anderson still lived with his parents. Desperate for medical help, the city's health committee hired him as a medical resident at the hospital. The pay was good because the risks were so high. Doctors did not know what caused the disease, nor how it spread. In the 18th and early 19th centuries, many European and American medical authorities suspected yellow fever spread through pestilential vapors emitted by rotting garbage. The symptoms of the disease were unmistakable. Some experienced only moderate fever and headache and fully recovered, but in severe cases, between 15 and 25%, patients who appeared to be on the mend abruptly worsened. Fever spiked, causing internal hemorrhaging and bleeding from the nose, eyes, and ears. Some vomited blackened blood. Liver damage led to jaundice, turning skin and eyes yellow. Hence the name. It would take scientists more than a century to discover that the virus was spread in cities by a unique species of mosquito, the Aedes aegypti. Not until 1937, would medical researchers develop a vaccine. Today, the disease kills around 30,000 people each year, overwhelmingly in Africa. The outbreak of 1793 almost exclusively affected Philadelphia, where people sensed it was contagious. Acquaintances and friends avoided each other in the streets and only signified their regard by a cold nod, one Philadelphian noted at the time. The old custom of shaking hands fell into such general disuse that many were affronted at even the offer of a hand. Similarly, some people held a handkerchief drenched in vinegar to their nose to filter the noxious air. When the disease came to New York in 1795, residents called the nightmarish experiences of Philadelphians 2 years earlier. The ravages made by the fever in Philadelphia filled the minds of the inhabitants of New York City with terror. Anderson's mother, Sarah, wrote to him in September 1795. Upward of 700 New Yorkers died during the fall of 1795, before cold weather killed the mosquitoes and put an end to the year's epidemic. Commended for his work at Bellevue, Anderson returned to Columbia to complete his medical education. By August 1798, Sandy Anderson, now 23 and a fully licensed physician, was reeling after a hard summer. He and his new wife, Nancy, had lost their infant son in July, possibly from dysentery, and Nancy had gone to stay with relatives in Bushwick, a rural area in Brooklyn that required Anderson to take a ferry and a carriage ride of several miles when he visited. "This morning I found myself weak, indolent, forgetful, miserable," he wrote shortly afterward. "'Twas with difficulty I could drag myself out to see my parents." A couple of weeks later, he confessed that I am obliged to support myself by wine and a little opium. New York's health commissioners had believed that with careful quarantining of occasional cases, the city could avoid another full epidemic of the kind it had seen 3 years earlier. At one point, in mid-August 1798, city officials welcomed an intense 3-day downpour of rain, which they believed would cleanse the city streets and purify the air. "Alas, our expectations in this respect were dreadfully disappointed," one New Yorker wrote. "The storm was followed by a heat wave, and the water that had puddled in yards, streets, and basements was a perfect breeding ground for mosquitoes." For the first time since 1795, Bellevue Hospital reopened. Anderson returned on August 31st. Conditions were bad. 20 patients awaited him. 4 died by the evening. He admitted 14 more the first day. Deaths were gruesome and the agony of the loved ones unbearable to witness. "We had some difficulty in getting rid of an Irishman who'd wished to stay and nurse his sweetheart at night," he wrote. "My spirits sank." Meanwhile, some of the nurses began to get sick. For a few days in early September, he began recording statistics in the diary. 9 admitted, 4 died. Anderson abandoned the record-keeping on September 4th when a friend arrived at Bellevue to tell him that his wife was sick with the fever. On the following day, his father came to the hospital to say that Sandy's brother John had fallen ill as well. For a few days, Anderson tried to care for everyone, his wife in Bushwick and the rest of his relations downtown, plus dozens of Bellevue patients. Then on September 8th, a heavy blow. "I saw my brother this morning and entertained hopes of his recovery. In the afternoon, I found him dead. Yet he could not rest to grieve. I left my poor parents struggling with their fate and returned to Bellevue." Before setting aside the diary that day, he paused to sketch a small coffin next to the entry. His father died on September 12th. Anderson sketched another coffin next to that entry. In Bushwick, he found his wife in shocking condition. "The sight of my wife, ghastly and emaciated, constantly coughing and spitting, struck me with horror." She died on September 13th. He drew another coffin. His mother, the final member of his immediate family, took ill on the 16th and died on the 21st, another coffin. "I shall never look upon her like again," he wrote. By the time the outbreak abated, as mosquitoes died off in cold weather, Anderson had lost 8 members of his family and almost all my friends. Distraught, he quit his job at Bellevue and rejected other offers of medical work. A few months earlier, he seemed to have everything before him. The 1798 epidemic wiped it all away. When I first read Anderson's diary in Columbia's Rare Books Library in 2005, I found myself weeping at the human loss and the sight of the sketch coffins in the margins by a diarist I found so appealing. His experience had just been so relentless. I had to leave the quiet seclusion of the library and walk over to the anonymous bustle on Broadway and 116th to collect myself. We have grown accustomed to learning about an epidemic from statistics. Throughout COVID-19, we have grasped at numbers, charts, percentages, 6 feet apart, number of tests per day, spikes and curves, and well over 2 million deaths worldwide. Anderson's diary reminds us of those who experienced the daily life of the epidemic. It was the very dailiness of his chronicle, the intimacy of his portrait of his encounter with nightmarish disease, that drew me back as another pandemic emerged in 2020. I took a walk to the burial ground where the sight of Nancy's grave riveted my thoughts to that amiable being and was good as a sermon as any I've heard. He wrote in late October 1798. A few days later, he commented, "My acquaintances are fast flocking into town after evacuating, and many a one greets me with a rueful countenance." On New Year's Eve, he offered a few remarks on past year. "A tremendous scene have I witnessed," he wrote, "but yet I have reason to thank the great author of my existence." In addition to his religious faith, he added, "I have made more use of liquor than all in my life together, and sincerely compute the preservation of my life to it." It took time, but Anderson moved on. He never returned to practicing medicine. He also seems to have ceased keeping a diary after 1799. Instead, he became an engraver, acclaimed for carving images on blocks of wood, talents that eventually made him much more famous in his time than he was when he was a doctor. He remarried, had 6 children, and ultimately professed pride in having chosen an artisan's life over a physician's high pay and social status. When he died in 1870, at age 94, the New York Historical Society remembered Anderson as a pioneer in the beautiful and useful art of woodgraving. Though his engravings are undeniably charming, it's Anderson's account of his work in the yellow fever wards that resonates most powerfully today. Anderson's diary reveals a similar slow-motion horror story to the one threatening us now. Embedded in those diary entries, in the ink that has turned brown after more than 200 years, is a reminder that he sought to help, suffered, and survived. It has helped remind me that we will too. Next, we'll move on to a short article titled "Engineering Immunity, A Bracing History of the Ingenuity and Value of Inoculations" by Amy Crawford. Today's vaccines may be high-tech lab creations, but the practice of inoculation predates our modern understanding of pathogens by nearly a millennium. From early daring efforts to prevent smallpox to modern public health campaigns, our long struggle against infectious disease is a testament to ingenuity and the courage of people who put their bodies on the line. Circa 1000, Puff of Prevention. Its origins are murky, but inoculation against smallpox most likely began in China during the Song Dynasty. Prime Minister Wang Tang's empire-wide call for a weapon against the disease was answered by a mysterious monk, or possibly a nun, who visited the prime minister from a retreat on Mount Emei. The monastic's technique, blowing a powder of ground smallpox scabs into the patient's nose, remained in use for centuries in China. 1777, Troop Strength. George Washington, who'd contracted smallpox as a young adult, ordered inoculations against the disease for all continental regulars. Some 40,000 men were treated by year's end. The procedure involved cutting the skin and inserting diseased tissue from a smallpox patient. "Should the disorder infect the army," Washington wrote, "we should have more to dread from it than the sword of the enemy." 1885, Pasteur's Gamble. After a rabid dog mauled a 9-year-old boy from Alsace, Joseph Meister, his mother, took him to the Paris laboratory of Louis Pasteur, who was experimenting with a rabies vaccine made from the spinal cords of afflicted rabbits. Pasteur hadn't tested it on humans, but agreed to treat the boy. Spared from the deadly brain virus, Joseph grew up to work at the Research Institute Pasteur founded in 1887. 1956, The King and His Followers. In the mid-1950s, millions of American children received a newly developed polio vaccine. But public health authorities lamented that teens and adults were not getting the shot. Then Elvis Presley, 21, agreed to be jabbed for the cameras before performing on The Ed Sullivan Show. Photos of the injection helped improve vaccine acceptance. By 1960, polio incidence was one-tenth of the 1950 level. Next, we'll move on to another article in the prologue section, National Treasure this time, titled The Secret Garden by Alexis Coe. A gown worn by Martha Washington reveals a dimension of her nature that few have been aware of. Ask any American what Martha Washington looked like, and you'll hear of a kindly, plump grandmother, her neck modestly covered and her gray hair poking out of a round, frilled mob cap, as she was portrayed in Gilbert Stuart's 1796 portrait. Her husband explained her straightforward style in a 1790 letter. Martha's, quote, wishes coincide with my own as to simplicity of dress and everything which can tend to support propriety of character without partaking of the follies of luxury and ostentation, end quote. Martha, then the first lady, was 65 when she sat for that famous portrait, but in earlier paintings she is slim, her neckline plunging, décolletage on full display, her dark hair offset with a fashionable bonnet. Make no mistake about it, Martha was considered attractive. Her wardrobe, including custom-made slippers and purple satin with silver trimmings, which she paired with a silk dress with a deep yellow brocade and rich lace on her wedding day, indicates a fashionista who embraced bold colors and sumptuous fabrics that conveyed her lofty social and economic standing. And it wasn't just Martha, or Lady Washington as she was called. The couple's ledgers are full of extravagant clothing purchases, for George as well. I made use of those sources in my biography of George Washington, You Never Forget Your First, but I felt frustrated by the limited descriptions of Martha that we find in letters, and which focus almost exclusively on her role as wife, mother, and enslaver. Biographers have tended to value her simply as witness to a great man. Artists painted her according to the standards of the time, with details one would expect to see any woman in her position, nothing particular to this woman. Indeed, Martha might be pleased by how little we know about her inner life. After George died, she burned all the letters from their 40-year marriage, although a few have been discovered stuck in the back of a desk drawer. Historians are limited by the archives and by ourselves. Biographers study documents to tell the story of a person's life, using clothes and accessories to add color to their accounts. But if we're missing something that's obvious because we don't know what to look for? Of Martha's few surviving dresses, I spent the most time looking at one. And when I imagine Martha, I picture her in this specific dress. She wore it during the 1780s, a period I think of as the Washington's second chance as a normal life. They were no longer royal subjects or colonists, but citizens. George was world famous and finally satisfied with life. Martha was happily raising the young children of her late ne'er-do-well son, John Park Custis, as well as her nieces and nephews. They have experienced loss, triumph, life outside Virginia, and believed erroneously that their life of public service had ended with the American Revolution. By the end of that decade, of course, they would become the first family. But was I seeing her clearly? The catalog entry for the dress listed the pattern I remembered, with flowers, butterflies, and ladybugs, and other parts I didn't remember. I suddenly found it odd that the 58 insects on the dress included beetles, ants, and spiders, but I don't know the reasons behind the images. Assuming Martha chose the pattern, it revealed something important. Zara Anishanslin, historian of material culture, who has spent time at Washington's home at Mount Vernon as a researcher and fellow, posed an intriguing theory to me. Martha was a naturalist, Anishanslin explained. Or rather, Martha would have been a naturalist had she been born a man or in a different era. She had very few ways of expressing her passion for the natural world, which makes it easy to overlook. As Anishanslin spoke, I was riveted, in part because after reading every Martha Washington biography, this was the only new original insight I've ever come across about her, and I wonder what the best medium would be to convey this forgotten element of Martha's life. An academic history would hardly be the best medium to spotlight objects attesting to Martha's passion for nature. A museum exhibition would be better. If I were curating such an exhibition, I would place this dress in the largest of three glass cases, front and center. In another, I would display the 12 seashell pattern cushions Martha made with the help of enslaved women at Mount Vernon. In the third, I'd display 12 Months of Flowers, one of the only books from her first marriage to Daniel Park Custis that she kept for personal use. The arrangement would be the first chance to see Martha's husband used as accessories to enhance our understanding of her. I'd call the exhibition, Don't Be Fooled by the Bonnet. We'll move to a Smithsonian Voice next, titled Who is Grace Anna Lewis, Naturalist and Abolitionist by Aaron Rushing. To her mind, the truths of science seem revealed. That's how Phoebe A. Hannaford, author of Daughters of America, circa 1882, described naturalist Grace Anna Lewis, one of the first three women to be accepted into the Academy of Natural Sciences. But Lewis was not only one of the first professionally acknowledged women naturalists, she was also an abolitionist and social reformer who worked for the advancement of science as well as human rights. Researchers can find many publications by and about this intriguing woman in Smithsonian Libraries and Archives Digital Library and the Biodiversity Heritage Library. Born in 1821, Lewis benefited from an egalitarian Quaker upbringing, one that encouraged education in daughters as well as sons. Lewis told Hannaford that she always loved natural history from her mother, that she'd learned to love natural history from her mother, Esther Lewis. Esther had been a teacher before marriage and continued to educate her own young children, sending her daughters to the nearby Kimberton boarding school as they grew. There, Grace Anna was influenced by Abigail Kimber, a woman botanist who had discovered and identified several species. In 1842, Lewis's uncle, Dr. Bartholomew Fussell, started a new boarding school for girls, and Lewis came on board as a teacher. She taught astronomy and botany, among other subjects. From her family, Grace Anna Lewis inherited not only an interest in science and education, but also a deep concern for social issues. Uncle Bartholomew was an active abolitionist, and the family formed a local auxiliary of the American Anti-Slavery Society. The Lewis sisters, Grace Anna, Mary Ann, and Elizabeth, were profiled in William Still's The Underground Railroad, 1872, which described them as among the most faithful, devoted, and quietly efficient workers in the anti-slavery cause. One of Grace Anna's earliest publications, written in the 1840s, was an appeal to those members of the Society of Friends who, knowing the principles of the abolitionists, stand aloof from the anti-slavery enterprise. It implored fellow Quakers to join the anti-slavery movement. The Lewis Farm in Pennsylvania became a frequent and successful point on the Underground Railroad, described in detail by Still. The family helped transport those seeking freedom and provided clothes and supplies. Eventually, Lewis moved away from the family farm to Philadelphia. She had studied birds and other natural sciences on her own, but this move allowed her to take advantage of the specimen and library collections at the nearby Academy of Natural Sciences, and it propelled her into the network of naturalists. In 1862, she met John Cason, ornithologist and curator of birds at the Academy. Cason had written, with George N. Lawrence and the Smithsonian's own Spencer Baird, The Birds of North America, 1860, a work Lewis found particularly inspiring. Cason would be an invaluable friend and mentor to Lewis, even naming a bird for her, Icterius Grace Annae, the white-edged oriole. Lewis also corresponded frequently with Baird for years, seeking advice and asking for copies of Smithsonian publications. In 1870, the year after Cason's death, Lewis became one of the first three women admitted as members to the Academy. Lewis had channeled her interest in ornithology into her first scientific publication, Natural History of Birds, Lectures on Ornithology in 10 Parts, 1868. It was intended as an inexpensive overview of American birds for a general audience. In it, she also proposed a new classification scheme based on embryology, the characteristics of eggs. Unfortunately, only the first part was published, as funding for the remaining nine was never secured. She continued to research and publish on birds alongside the leading naturalists of her time. Her articles in The American Naturalist, The Lyre Bird, August 1870, and Symmetrical Figures in Birds' Feathers, November 1871, are available in the Biodiversity Heritage Library. Lewis's interests and publications grew beyond ornithology into the classification of natural history and a tree of life, which she exhibited at the Centennial Exhibition in 1876. The Development of the Animal Kingdom, 1877, available in the Biodiversity Heritage Library, is a 20-page overview of her theories. It was prepared for the fourth meeting of the Association for the Advancement of Women. The group was formed in 1868 with the goal of presenting practical methods for improving women's role in society, including education on a variety of subjects. Unsurprisingly, Lewis was active on the group's Committee on Science. Lewis told Phoebe A. Hannaford in 1882, "I feel that my life's work is before me, and lecturing on zoology to girls just blooming into womanhood." For the next 20 years, Lewis continued to teach and write about various natural history topics. Her article on the genus Hyliota, discussing the distinction of two rare African birds, was published in the Annals and Magazine of Natural History in 1883. Her social reform interests turned to temperance and suffrage, serving stints as secretary for her local chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union and Suffrage Association. Grace Anna Lewis died in 1912 in Media, Pennsylvania at the age of 90. Her contributions to both science and social progress leave a remarkable and inspiring legacy. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.